David, let's rock a little bit. Let's get updates on a couple of UFO cases, one in Mexico, the other in Venice. What can you tell us?
Okay, well, let's actually, for the one in Mexico, and this is a bit of a twist, but let's go back to the night of March 12, 2001, when I was on your show with James Oberg. And the moment Oberg and I were arguing about whether the cameras on the shuttle, the black and white cameras, could see the invisible ultraviolet and infrared, Oberg said it couldn't, and I had absolutely confirmed this with head of astrochemistry at NASA, Joseph Knuth, that the camera could see near ultraviolet and infrared.
Okay.
And that was the moment, right down to the second, that the internet and the satellite turned off and we were booted off the air.
Yes.
Now, before we go to Mexico again, let's go to, okay, Dan Aykroyd was producing a show called Out There in 2000 on the Sci-Fi Channel. He told me, this was days before I was to be flown to New York for my show, he was interviewing Stephen Greer, and lo and behold, during the taping, they were taping as if live, James Oberg calls in, good old James Oberg at NASA, and Oberg calls in and was really upset, Dan said. I mean, I just interviewed Aykroyd for an hour and 20 minutes for my next film, Evidence 2.
Yeah, and everybody will recall I had Dan Aykroyd on the show with you as well.
That was December 5th, 2001. Then what happens is Aykroyd tells me in the interview the other day, I was interviewing him on the set, and he said within 24 hours, he was standing outside during one of the breaks, and Oberg, he said, was very disturbed by Stephen Greer, the fact that he had so many credible, you know, Air Force pilots and astronauts like Cooper testifying to having seen UFOs. Aykroyd said he was on his cell phone. This is kind of funny. He was talking to Britney Spears, and he turned and looked, and he saw a black sedan, long sedan, with men standing outside, black sunglasses, black suits, and with these earpieces in, and he said they beckoned him with a look of total intimidation. And Dan, Brittany said something to him. He said he turns his head.
You mean like, want to take a ride?
Want to take a ride, and then he turns and looks back, and the car is gone, and he said there's no way it could have hopped over the other cars. The men were standing outside the car. There's no way in a turn of a neck that they could have disappeared. And he is convinced that these guys were some sort of interdimensional, who knows, limousine. And then what happens?
Maybe it was just an effect of talking to Britney.
Well, no, watch what happens next. Within 24 hours, his show is canceled. Now, remember, we had Oberg on with us, and the show, the satellite turned off, and the internet turned off.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Then Aykroyd has Oberg on his show with Stephen Greer.
Poof.
His whole show is canceled. Sci-Fi tells him the show was canceled. In fact, they tied him up in lawsuits so he couldn't even sell it to another network. Now, isn't that interesting? Now, that's you know, I was supposed to fly to New York 2 days later to do my show with Dan, and he said,
I remember the cancellation. I remember the shock of the cancellation.
Yeah. Dan and Peter Aykroyd are both disturbed to this day. I told Dan it was an apparition for his eyes only to let him know that someone at a higher level had shut down his show, because this wasn't mere entertainment. This was Stephen Greer with Project Disclosure, and this was, you know, me with the NASA stuff. So, you know, now let's go to Mexico. All of a sudden, Mexico happens. We have, let's look at the science on this, and it's pretty easy.
Well, describe for everybody what happened in Mexico.
Okay, in Mexico, what happens, I got a call from a friend of mine named David Sadler, who ran for Congress in Illinois, and he tipped me off to Jaime Musson doing this huge press conference in the early part of the month of May, and I notified Bob Tarlow, who's senior producer at Fox News. Tarlow gets the tape and puts it on Fox National within 6 hours. I mean, it was on National Fox. That footage was everywhere. And then all of a sudden, all the other stations followed pursuit, and I went on with George Noory that night to talk about it. Now, what is peculiar about the Mexico case and why it's so relevant to my work with the NASA UFOs is, once again, we have 11 UFOs confirmed on forward-looking infrared cameras that were, and three were detected on radar, the remaining eight were not, and they surrounded their aircraft, intimidating the pilots. And so let's look at, I have a very deep investigation into the Mexico case.
This really seems like almost a smoking gun kind of case.
It's absolutely smoking gun because you have no visual confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the same as the NASA tapes. We have translucent disks of light that are very large, perhaps 2 to 3 miles in diameter, only visible on the ultraviolet cameras.
Right, but again, with respect to the Mexican case, where has this gone? Because
okay,
many of these things just get dropped like they went off a cliff and you don't hear anything else.
I was interviewing, again for evidence, to a man named Ken Stork up in Denver, who was U.S. Air Force retired, and he said, Stork used to work in drug enforcement, he said Space Command had picked up these UFOs all the way down in, I believe it was Venezuela, and we notified the Mexican Air Force. Let me just clarify for people what Space Command is. Space Command has also satellite cameras that observe the Earth 24 hours a day in the visible wavelengths from the color red to violet. They also look in ultraviolet, near and far, and they look in infrared.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know whether they were visible or not, but we got a signal. We notified their Air Force. So that means they flew all the way from South America through Central America into Mexico. They launch their drug enforcement jets that have U.S. forward-looking infrared cameras, which really I have to clarify here, because forward-looking infrared are not ordinary infrared cameras. They incorporate two wavelengths of infrared, low frequency and high frequency infrared. They fuse them together so you get a two-dimensional infrared image with tremendous resolution.
David, I've been sitting in a Black Hawk,
mm-hmm.
and I've played with that radar.
Oh, you have?
Oh, yes, I have. And it's remarkable. I mean, it's... actually, for those of you who can't imagine it, it's really the next thing to a photograph.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of looking like, it's almost like looking at a negative photograph, and you can make out shapes of human beings, shapes of aircraft that are on the runway. If a car is driving past on a highway near the runway, you can see that. Everything in proper proportion, and you have quite a clear view.
Incredibly clear, beyond any normal infrared camera.
And absolutely.
I researched through DOD, and we have new infrared cameras, forward-looking infrared cameras, that are so far beyond the ones we sold Mexico, it would, I mean, really just make people's eyes pop wide open.
I'm sure.
So here's the deal. Now, remember, we have, okay, a temperature, they're flying at, 13,000 feet. It's minus, according to Jaime Musan's report, it's minus 26 degrees up there, which is easy to understand at that altitude.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get this infrared signature, very clear. In fact, the one that they target in on the it's called advanced target forward-looking infrared. You'll see the little X's. They actually target the objects, and that's for you know, our military
sure.
response.
Sure.
You can look at one of them with what they actually they square in on. You'll see a long cylinder-like thing with a round, you know, bulb or light shining from it. So you can see this thing has structure. But everyone is duped in this case because you have mass gone invisible. Now, I go back to my UFO sighting in Berkeley, 67, 68, and after 20 minutes of watching this shiny metallic disc, we saw it blink out. It just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, where did it go? And let's go even further back. Let's go back to, in fact, this gentleman came to my attention after Evidence One, the case for NASA UFOs, came out, and he saw it. Trevor James Constable is the author of The Cosmic Pulse of Life. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
Okay. 1976, he publishes his book. Trevor Constable is a retired British naval officer from World War II who started to notice invisible objects showing up on radar during World War II. And one case he cites in his book is called the Nansei Shoto case, where off the coast of Okinawa, Japan, our aircraft carriers saw on radar what we thought were 300 enemy aircraft doing 700 miles an hour. It was either 300 enemy aircraft or one whopping object. But we couldn't
imagine. That would get your attention.
That would get your attention. And, of course, we couldn't do 700 miles an hour in World War II because that's just beyond the sound barrier. And we didn't break it yet. So we thought the Russians or the Germans were going to clobber us. So we launched our fighters up on a clear day, very good visibility. Nothing is there. Yet radar on the ship is saying, we have confirmation, you're right on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing there. Now, those ghosts would show up on radar from time to time. So Trevor Constable goes out with a 35-millimeter camera, and he decides he's going to start taking pictures in the invisible. Using high-speed infrared film without red filter, you get near UV sensitivity plus infrared.
Sure.
He goes out in 1958 where a man named George Van Tassel is allegedly psychically channeling extraterrestrials. And I know that sounds kind of hokey, but he took pictures all around Van Tassel, and he had a large audience, and UFOs, a translucent large disc of light, oriented at steep angles away from the camera with black holes in the center, identical to the UFOs in the STS-75 mission, show up on his film. And that's why he got a hold of me. I mean, through my friend Lou Gatto. Lou Gatto introduced me to Constable and said, you have to read his book. And I'm like, oh, it's so old, I don't want to read it. And I finally read it, and Trevor Constable sees my video and says, we have to get together. When I saw his photos, I was just like, oh, my God, I've got NASA in checkmate. I mean, these are the argument at NASA on the STS-75 was we're looking at out-of-focus airy disks, which when a near-field piece of dust floats close to the camera, it produces this blob of out-of-focus light around it. Well, an airy disk cannot turn on a steep angle away from the camera like you'll see in Constable's photos, but they still have the black holes in the center, just like the ones that I cited in STS-75 and the other missions. So it looks like we have double confirmation of the same phenomena. And some of the objects that showed up on Constable's photography, he believes, are biological organisms.
Didn't somebody in the Mexican situation actually come out and almost make an official statement, or did make an official statement, suggesting that this was absolute proof of extraterrestrial beings visiting Earth?
It's got to be absolute proof. I mean, to me, what they're doing, to explain Mexico properly, I believe, and I have to make this simple for the audience, that because Einstein's law prohibits mass or spacecraft from attaining the speed of light, because it, as you go faster, inertia pushes on you and you get heavier, and the heavier you get, the more energy it takes to go a little bit faster. In subatomic particle accelerators, where we test acceleration on protons and muons, you know, that the components of atoms, we have got protons at Fermilab in Chicago up to 99.99% the speed of light. So how much energy does it take to get a mass that fast? Well, it takes a trillion electron volts of energy. A nuclear bomb releases 200 million using plutonium, 200 million electron volts. So a trillion is 5,000 times more energy than the bomb.
Right.
Now, when I asked at the end of the long conversation with Earl Van Lanningham at NASA about fusion, I popped a big question on him, and I said, have you guys made contact with extraterrestrials? And he said, no. When you consider Einstein's law, the amount of energy it would take to get a spacecraft to be doing 99% the speed of light, he said the energy signal radiating from that craft would be so massive, it would be 1 trillion electron volts, would be so massive that every amateur radio astronomer in the world would see the signal moving towards Earth well in advance of the arrival of the spacecraft. And he said, we have never seen anything like that yet. Now, he's right, because you could never cover this up. Every amateur astronomer, it would be like the movie Contact. You would see a whopping, you know, a terabyte signal, a trillion bytes, beyond the Jansky signal, the gigawatt signal they're seeing in the movie. I mean, a trillion is so far beyond that.
Yeah, if it's fully a physical, real manifestation, then yes.
Yes, that's the point. Now, in my theory, I say it's impossible for too many reasons. One, no physical materials can produce energy levels that high. And even if you could get a spacecraft to even do one-tenth the speed of light, imagine the G-forces on even a subtle turn. They're going to crush the craft and the pilot. Even like, say you have to steer out of the way from an asteroid or an incoming moonlet, you're finished. The G-forces on a quick turn like that are going to destroy you going that fast.
Sure.
And second, imagine if you hit a rock floating in space. It's just going to puncture holes in you and blow you to pieces. But my theory, I reverse the table. I actually get into this very deeply, which, you know, it's very hard to do unless you have paper and a chalkboard in front of you. I believe they convert their mass into light, which means their craft go from a heavy mass state into a zero mass state.
Right.
And once a spacecraft is as light as a photon, Guess how much energy it takes to do the speed of light?
Nowhere near as much.
Nothing. A couple of volts. Because we can send radio photons out at a few volts throughout space.
Quite true.
And so that would mean that NASA could not detect the signal. See, either this is the fundamental point of why mainstream physicists do not take the UFO phenomena seriously, because they don't see the energy signal tagged on to the incoming objects. They see no energy signal. But if you have a zero energy signal and your craft is pure waveform energy, and I demonstrate this in my work very clearly, we'll get into the Venice UFO in a minute too. Because
yeah, the problem is they are here.
They are here.
Mexico happened.
And if their craft are pure ultraviolet wavelengths are they're higher in temperature than visible light. Now imagine minus 26 degrees at 26,000 feet, and this high temperature signal imprints that humidity. Actually, according to Hamid Musan's report, it was quite humid. That humidity in the atmosphere gets hot, and an infrared camera sees it like an infrared beacon, so you get an image print, like a fingerprint, against the atmosphere in the infrared, but the real UFO is way up higher. It's up in the X-ray, gamma ray, ultraviolet. It's way up there. That's what I believe happened, and that, when we look at the radar report, now radar is microwaves. We bounce microwaves out. We saw three of the Mexican UFOs on radar, but the remaining eight were not. Now
That's right. Is
perfect. Showing you how they have, some of them are in translucent mass states where the microwave photons just pass right through them like butter and you get no signal, and some of the others are in very low mass states but still invisible, and some of the photons or the radar photons bounce off of them and you get a signal. So they're basically telling you, I mean, if you read the signs, you can see exactly what they're doing. You have to become ultimately so frustrated with the idea of increasing energy on mass propulsion to come to the conclusion that they're doing it a different way. And the different way is I don't believe they're doing what Bob Lazar says. Bob Lazar's theory says is they are building their own gravity generators using element 115, which element 115, plutonium is like 97. So 115 has more visible energy than plutonium. So he's increasing energy on mass, and in fact, if you increase an object's or a spacecraft's gravity, you have to increase its mass, because that's how you increase gravity.
There have been some rather tantalizing stories recently about element 115. You're aware of that?
I know, I'm very aware. At Berkeley, they finally duplicated it, and what's really disturbing to me is Bob Lazar's formula is so close. It's so close to how they actually did it at Berkeley. In fact, they're on to element 116 now, but they
yes,
have not...
Yes, I know. Hold on, David. We're here at the bottom of the hour. That's all true. Lazar told that story so many years ago about element 115, and yet here come the stories about element 115. So what do you think? They're here? We can't see them? But perhaps in other spectrums and other vibration states, you can?